track session number 19911, reel 4.
Eric Lord, reel 4. And as I was walking along, the crowd started to gather around me and asked for my autograph. It was something of an experience, possibly the only time in my life I've ever been asked for an autograph. We really felt like conquering heroes, as I said before. And then, of course, it wasn't a case of staying in Brussels and enjoying all the spoils of the victors. No, nothing like that for this lot. We moved to the outskirts of Brussels, and there we dug in a hill on the outskirts and waited. We were only there a short time, but here a little story which I do recall. The state trench, in my state trench, sharing it with me was Alfie Cope. Alfie was a guardsman who had served in the army in the time of Dunkirk and had a nasty wound on his head to prove it. He was in a state pretty much in a bad state. His nerves had obviously gone. And I always remember he was in the slit trench with me. Nothing was happening because by that time the Germans were far away. And he was shaking almost. And I said, "Look, Alfie, can I do anything for you? Do you want me to have a word with the officer when he comes round?" And he said, "Would you?" So it wasn't my place, of course, to do anything like this. Anyway, the officer, Captain Fanning, came round inspecting the positions. And he, "Everything all right here?" "Excuse me, sir," I said, "could I have a word with you?" "Yes, Lord, what is it?" "Well," I said, "it's Cope, sir. I'm afraid his nerve's gone. And I'm sorry to say, sir, he's having a bad effect on the rest of the section." "Oh," he said, "is he? I'll see about that." I've often thought about that little exchange, and I realised I had omitted some very important words. I should have said, "And after you've taken him out of it, for Christ's sake, take me out of it as well, will you?" However, they did eventually take Alfie out of the thing altogether, which is they should have done some time before.
Had anything special happened to him to make his nerve go rather than somebody else's nerve to go?
He had endured the Dunkirk, the incidents at Dunkirk, 1940, and this possibly had quite an effect on him, quite an impact on him. He was nervous before we landed in Normandy, and certainly all through Normandy, I'm afraid, he certainly showed his fright. And of course we're all frightened, but Alfie, his nerves had gone, and really he should have been taken out of the campaign altogether.
Was there a danger of your nerve going then?
That's a good point, is that. I'm not sure about this. Not actually my nerve. Obviously, there have been some very close calls in Normandy, some very near misses and so on. But I don't think the nerve was in any danger of going. Not that I was brave, as absolutely, like most of the chaps I was with. They were frightened as well. Everybody was frightened, I think. I'm pretty sure they were.
So what happened next?
Well, from that position outside Brussels, we formed into line again with all the battalion vehicles, and off we went in the direction of Burg Leopold. And here, I can always remember that day leaving Brussels, leaving the civilization behind and travelling along through the Belgian countryside, and the day was one of those grey, sullen days, and even the landscape was threatening. We were apprehensive. It was such a contrast. We had an idea that the good times were over. And that night when we got near Berg Leopold, we were shelled.
Have you many recollections about being shelled on that occasion, pushing towards Berg Leopold?
The whole episode of in the area of Berg Leopold becomes very hazy. It was being plunged back into almost like a Normandy scenario again. The battalion did, I'm afraid, suffer quite a lot of casualties there. Eventually, the whole thing was abandoned, the attack on Berg Leopold, and next came the advance for the whole division and the corps, as far as that goes, to make progress towards Arnhem, and where the first airborne would be dropped. First of all, the journey came to something of a halt at the Eske Canal, or Esko Canal, where we were dug in and received some attention from the enemy in attacks from both sides of the centre line. When the advance came across the Eske Canal, I was rather apprehensive that it was going to be a terrible time for the main attacking force. The main attacking force to go across the bridge over the Eske Canal were the Irish Guards tanks. There was a great delay before the whole ensemble moved off. Of course, there was the original artillery barrage, smoke, what have you. But the Irish Guards tanks suffered enormously in their dash to break through the bridgehead. And I'm afraid it was like consigning the leading tanks, the men in the leading tanks, like consigning them to their deaths. Many years after, I was watching a television program where one of the tourist parties in Arnhem were talking about the Arnhem campaign and about the airborne division being beleaguered there, and saying, what were the guards doing? Were they making toast? I was very furious when I heard these remarks, because the people, as I say, the chaps in those tanks leading the charge across, had absolutely no chance at all. The burnt out tanks were all there for us to see when we advanced and made our way through Holland. The first town, of course, we came to was the I've forgotten which town it is.
Not Nijmegen?
No, I forgot. Eindhoven. Eindhoven. Oh God, the memory. I wish they're recording. We are. I wish they're recording.
No, sorry. Yes.
Yes, they're recording. Sorry about this. Eindhoven. And here again, the Dutch citizens turned out and welcomed us with beer and acclamation. And for their pains, after we'd gone, the Germans bombed them. Yes. And then, of course, it was on the long road leading to Nijmegen. And here we came across the American airborne forces, parachutes scattered all over the place, and on towards the Nijmegen itself. We rendezvoused just south of Nijmegen, and here we managed to link up with some of the outlying units of the American airborne forces. In doing so, we sort of claimed, or at least the section, the carrier section I was in, we claimed that we were the first British troops to cross the German border. Eventually, we rendezvoused again, lagered again, and here We set up one morning. I always remember this particular incident where the whole battalion was lined up in the vehicles, all ready to move off, and it was one of those misty mornings. Nothing happening at all quiet around where we were. And then, all of a sudden, swooping down from above, an aeroplane opened up on us. He swept the line, the long line of vehicles, his machine guns chattering away there. And I dived on the ground and then got ready for his next attack. Managed to get my brain gun. I even managed to find the correct ammunition and got ready, and in true style, waited until he came. And then I opened up, and some of those had managed to grab their brain guns too, and opened up nicely. They say the aircraft came down later, but whether it did, I don't know. It would be nice to think that I scored a target. I was a bit surprised when a sergeant fellow called Sergeant Brown, was shouting at me, "Help me, help me." And when I looked, his trousers were on fire. An incendiary bullet from the aircraft had set his trousers ablaze, and I was able to help him and put it out another few centimetres, and his whole leg would have been shattered. The move to what I call the island came later. The first airborne division, of course, were in serious trouble. The division couldn't make any progress to relieve them at Arnhem, and so the scene was unfolded for a terrible tragedy. Behind us, the centre line was cut so that trucks, soft vehicles travelling up and down there were attacked by the Germans further back. So it was becoming an absolute fiasco. As I said, some of the, at least I didn't say this, but some of the airborne forces did manage to get back to our side. And then it was our turn to take over defensive position on what we call the island, over the river. The Irish Guards were holding the line there. We took over on a nighttime hour positions, and I always remember that it was one of those horrible situations where you're not sure where the enemy is, and we were detailed to take over a particular ward. Now, I'm talking about our platoon, and the dead of night, taking over an unoccupied position, not knowing whether the Germans are there, is rather say fraught with peril. I remember I was leading the section, and with my brain gun in my hands, stealthily making my way through this wood, the leading man, and thinking to myself, "What the hell am I doing here?" And I thought I'd better get ready to have one up the breech ready. So I cocked the brain gun, and as I did so, I hadn't cocked it properly, and the shot rang out through the air in the stillness, and you can guess the effect on everybody else around. And Captain Fanning, the platoon officer, came up and he said, "What's happening?" And I said, "I thought I saw a Jerry." I was lying, of course. "Oh," he said, "don't fire unless you actually see anybody." So we dug in at night time, trying to get slit trenches dug through tree roots and so on. Eventually got some slits dug at the edge of the wood, and our carriers were parked in the wood itself. Here we stayed for several days, and where we were, we had quite a charmed existence. We couldn't move very far because we knew we were under observation. At night time, when we occupied the slits at the edge of the wood, German patrols would come along and fire into us and shout and bawl, trying to make us reveal our positions, but we kept quiet. In the rest of the island, we call it the island, actually, it was the land between the two rivers, the rest of the island was getting a pounding, absolute pounding from the German artillery, the battalion headquarters that was under great siege. As I said, all was quiet with us, and then one day we're gathered around our Bren-Gun carriers in the middle of the wood, and we hadn't much water, of course, and it was rather awful just having to, we had to shave in what water we had, and the rest went for making tea and drinking, not enough to wash with. And I always remember this particular day, we were gathered near our Bren-Gun carriers. We'd dug pits underneath just in case we were shelled or mortared, and for some reason the Germans decided to mortar us there, and over it came, whiz bang, whiz bang. Well, there was a wholesale dive into these trenches underneath the carriers, and I felt a thwack on my posterior, and I thought, oh crikey, and it was only a scratch actually, but I've always smiled about it, that the only time I was wounded was when I was in full retreat from the enemy. Well, that position was a very, very difficult position as far as washing and being able to carry on life in any normal degree. But eventually, we were pulled out of the line on one dark night, stealthily pulled out, and quite happily made our way back across the bridge and the Nijmegen Bridge, and back into relative safety. And here the battalion set up a rendezvous, and for a short spell we were at rest.
Did you round about this time get any leave going back to England?
No, what surprised me that later on there would be leave. Leave was started in January 1945. This always surprised me that in the middle of a war that they could start granting leave to the forces. It really was amazing.
Did you get some yourself then?
Yes, we dug it in a quiet part of just over the German border, and we were dug in, and I got my name was taken out of the hat, and yes, so I got a leave back, a week's leave back in to England. Rather surprising, as I say.
What did you do with the leave?
I came home, and it was very welcome, I assure you. What was rather interesting, not only that, but I also, my name came out of the hat to pay a short visit to Brussels, where, as I say, we're a quiet part of the line just over the German border nearer, and over on the other side, on the Dutch side, the town of Sittard, I remember that. That was the area. And from this quiet part of the line, I remember this 48 hours leave I got to Brussels. And here I got a tremendous surprise when life here was really being lived up. All the bars, the dance halls, even subdued lights in the street. I do remember talking to a Belgian civilian who was getting rather apprehensive from his reports in the Belgian papers that the Germans had broken through in the Ardennes, and he was asking me what I thought to it, what would happen, would the Germans be able to break through altogether into Belgium. I really assured him that no such thing would happen and the line would be held. I didn't realise at that time what a terrific onslaught the Germans were making in the Ardennes.
When you went back on leave to England, what was the attitude of the civilian population in England to what was happening on the continent?
I think everyone had their own troubles at that particular time. Of course, there was this, rationing was everywhere. The only people, I think, who were having a good time were people who were operating in the black market. Farmers, perhaps, who were didn't want for very much. Most people carried on their work in stoical fashion. They were of the sort of frame of mind, we'll leave it to you, that's your job, you're a soldier. And certainly there's lots of mothers and fathers very anxious about their offspring who were away in the forces. But the majority of civilians, I think, were thinking to themselves, the war's hard for us too. I don't think anyone can understand what it's like to be shelled and bombed frequently unless you actually take part. I remember when the railway journey home, when I came home on leave, been in a railway carriage, and there was a military policeman, not the normal military police, he was what we called a VP policeman, a vulnerable point policeman. He wore a sort of a blue cap, and there was a railway man in the compartment, that's all, just the three of us, and this railway man, on his last leg of the journey, he said to this military policeman, "What's things like over there?" And the military policeman said, "Oh, not bad at all." And I thought, it's all right for you, chum, guarding some bridge or other way back from the front line. Now, there's a hell of a chasm between those who are up at the sharp end and those not. If I can remember that Brussels was absolutely teeming with base troops, having a whale of a time.
Can I ask you, jump ahead further into 1945, and ask you about the pursuit through Germany. Did you come across many German civilians at that time?
I think that the relations were very limited with any of the German population as far as we were concerned. The one incident which I remember, as of course some of them were fleeing, we come across a convoy, horses and carts, pulling carts with all the possessions aboard. And I always remember this particular time we were waiting to go forward, and there's this long line of horses and carts coming along this long line, and I was stood by the roadside, and as this particular procession came along, there was a young girl sat up above on top of the cart with all the possessions with our presumed father, and she looked at me and I looked at her, and if you've ever witnessed hatred in anyone's eyes, and she looked at me, and of course I didn't know a little bit of German at that time, so I shouted out to her, "Denken Sie an," and I started to reap up "thank you" on Poland, on France, on all the other, Russia and so on, all the terrible things you've committed, and but it didn't alter her gaze at all, but I couldn't help getting it in. She was obviously hating me. But if I could just make a point that the British troops behaved impeccably towards the German civilians, not always, I'm generalising, but compared with some of the rest of the Allies, the Americans and the French, the British behaved in wonderful style.
Where did you end up in Germany by VE Day?
There was, of course, this skips an awful lot in the approach to the Rhine, where the battalion collected an enormous number of casualties at that particular juncture. Once we got across the Rhine, it was a case of the tanks leading the way for so long, then the infantry would take over. There was points of resistance here, there and everywhere. It wasn't a gallop a lot through Germany at all. It was some very strong points of resistance put up by the Germans. They were fighting for their homeland, and I'm afraid, you know, it was so nagging, the idea that he was so near and so far. So you hear one or two of our chaps saying, "Why don't the silly bastards give up?" There's no intention of giving up. There were quite a lot of sort of chaps coming in with their hands up. At the same time, there were so many strong points. One German, I can just remember, just as a final flourish, I remember one incident when I nearly came to grief. And this is where we were attacking a German town, the name escapes me now, and we were, our platoon was detailed to go and take an attack from the flank. And here on foot, we entered the town by the small town, by the suburbs, and I found myself leading the way again. Silly thing to do, wasn't it? And dashing across the road with my Sten gun in hand, I occupied the entrance to a house on the far side of the road. And of course, as I was not fired on, then it was okay for the rest of the section and the rest of the platoon to come across. And I decided to have a look upstairs in this house and see if I could get a vantage point from one of the windows. So as I entered the house, there's some people were downstairs in the cellar, and the old man came up the stairs from the cellar, and I said to him, any German soldiers here? 9999. So I thought, aye, all right. So I went upstairs and looked out the window. I was going to smash the window and, you know, have a look through there so I could be able to fire. I couldn't get a good view at all. So I came out downstairs and went outside, and there's another guardsman there. He said the rest of the platoon have gone further up the street. I said, all right, we'll just see what happens here a minute. And there was a low wall near the side of the house, which covered the window to the cellar, a low brick wall built for the purposes of preventing blast. And we stood by this wall, behind this wall, and just for a minute or two while I thought we'd better go and look for the rest of the platoon. And I saw some of our tanks starting to come in towards us at a distance from the edge of the town. And they were slowly coming towards us. And then this sixth sense came into play. And I said to this guardsman, get down quick. We ducked down behind that brick wall. The next second, and I mean a second, the whole masonry became alive as a whole hail of bullets hit that. We'd have been neatly cut in half if Hines had said, get down. And then, of course, they realised that it was friendly troops. And thankfully, but that was, you know, just one of those incidents that come to mind when it was very easy to be shot by one's own side. Well, eventually the end had to come. And we finished up at the aerodrome at Cuxhaven. And here we took the surrender of the German 7th Parachute Division. Now here's another memory that will stick in the mind forevermore. The German 7th Parachute Division, who were still had kept together as a unit, a fighting unit, marched onto Cuxhaven Aerodrome and to surrender. And here, one would have thought they would have crept in abjectly, dishevelled, a beaten foe. Were they a beaten foe? Were they hell? They all came in platoons, marching smartly, eins, zwei, drei, going on, singing away there. And I thought, my Christ, you know, this lot, oh dear. And just so that night, because it was the end of the war, of course it was, the issue was some rum, that's always so. There was no grand celebration, no grand celebration at all. It was, for me, I tried to think of, you know, think of some words that would equate the situation. That somebody might say something, an officer might say, well, lads, you've done well. Somebody to say something.